If you found $100 on the street, would you pick it up or would you keep walking? Of course you'd take the money. So why do you keep picking winners and not betting on them? That's why I go to MyBookie. It's fast, it's easy, and they pay when you win. Let's face it, where you're betting is just as important as who you're betting on. Do the smart thing. If you're going to bet this football season, bet with MyBookie. Did you know that you could bet on games after kickoff? If by the second half it looks like your bet is going to lose, you can always just take the other side. If you're the type of guy that likes to bet a little and win a lot, try a parlay. If all your picks come through, you'll multiply your winnings. And no matter how you bet, the NFL season is the best time of year. Join now and MyBookie will double your first deposit. Use promo code BLUEWIRE to activate the offer. That's promo code BLUEWIRE. Visit MyBookie.ag today. You play, you win, you get paid.
Blue Wire.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James! It's over! It's over! Cleveland is a city of champions once again!
The Cleveland Cavaliers select Colin Sexton, Darius Garland.
Here comes Sexton, some rhythm.
And he got it! Young Ball continues to wear him out!
Welcome to the Chase Down Podcast, part of the Blue Wire Network. I'm your host, Justin Rowan. Carter Rodriguez is not available this week, so instead I have a very special guest, senior NBA writer for 538, Chris Herring. Chris, how are you doing today?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing very well. You obviously have some big shoes to fill with Carter not being here, but unfortunately I do have to start this off with a very, very serious topic. In my opinion, one of the biggest debates that's out there, and that's how you feel about grown men wearing jerseys in public. I was listening to the Open Floor podcast, and I need to get your take, because Carter and I have had some debates over this subject. When are they appropriate for grown men to wear jerseys in public?
Hey, man. So I will put on the record that I'm not someone... I'm trying to think of the last time I've wore... Well, I wear college football jerseys. I actually have one that I like. Need to go ahead and wash for later this weekend because Michigan will play Wisconsin. So, I mean, in some ways you could argue that's more sad than I'm wearing, you know, jerseys. I don't know if it's actually a jersey number maybe that's on the team now, but, you know, wearing one, feeding into a system where players aren't being paid for those, but two, you know, like representing even younger people than NBA players in a lot of cases. So, I don't know that I feel like I can't judge anybody. And I really won't. I mean, there's so few realms in which adults can still be kids in a way. And if people want to buy jerseys, and, you know, I know that I have a couple friends that make it a point to basically find the most unique jerseys in the crowd that they can. I know Sean Hyken is like a huge fan of doing that at Summer League.
Right.
So all the more power to people that, you know, more power to people that go ahead and do that. I don't have an issue with it.
I agree. Like, to me, and I know it's not necessarily a good look, but my opinion is you can wear an NBA jersey in particular anytime you are going to wear a tank top. I feel like it's a safe assumption that you can sub that in. It's not always a great look, and especially after a long Canadian winter, I'm basically translucent, so I know it's not the best look, but I feel like I can still rock it at the gym. I can wear it at pickup. I can wear it wherever I'd like.
You know, I tweeted about this maybe 3 weeks ago too. And doing research for a book I'm working on about the 90s Knicks, I've had to go back and watch a lot of games, obviously, that are at the Garden, that take place at Madison Square Garden. And it's amazing to watch how many of the games just feature what seems like 25 to 30% of the crowd in full suits. And it's like such a jarring thing to watch, because now it looks really awkward to see people that are in suits. But,
right.
You know, I think particularly when the Knicks have games at home during the week, and you consider, you know, that on some level that was when I think you started to transition more to the corporate fan on some level too. You know, before there was like a such thing as like business casual and, you know, people being able to wear jeans on certain days of the week.
Right.
So like, you had a lot of people that were coming straight from Wall Street to go to the games. And so, you know, I think a jersey is a much better alternative. Now, it makes a lot more sense at games and stuff like that than it does just kind of in everyday life just to wear down the street. But
that's true.
We go through so many fluctuations of what is considered to be cool and what is kind of considered to be normal. And I think that you've got kind of a counterculture of folks that use them as well and wear them as well. So I think it's actually kind of cool on some level. I'm not going to be too critical of the people that do wear them.
Yeah, I like collecting jerseys. One thing I'll say is if you are wearing it at arena, you got to wear the undershirt. I think that's absolutely necessary.
I would prefer that too. which
actually is a kind of decent transition to someone that you wrote about back in March, which is Colin Sexton. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to add him to my jersey collection just because it just doesn't feel right to have another number two jersey, being such a Kyrie fan for all those years. But maybe... Yeah. It's possible he can work his way up there. I do like the throwbacks that the Cavs are going to. But you had written about kind of the growth in his game last season. And he was someone that I didn't really have high expectations for coming into this last season. I was kind of wondering what your thoughts of Sexton were prior to the season and how his year in totality kind of lived up to those expectations.
So I'll be totally... up front, and I've said this before, so it's not necessarily a secret to people that follow my work really, really, really closely. I don't really, you know, I think we have a certain number of guys. I think there are maybe 20, 30, some who are well more known in the media, and then some who are, you know, are still kind of building a name for themselves, mm-hmm. who really get a really firm opportunity to watch a lot of college basketball and a lot of pro basketball.
Right.
I've never really considered myself to be one of those. Maybe in 2015, the Knicks were so horrible that year. I think they won 17 games. And so I kind of peeled away from covering them day to day while I was on that beat to basically go start scouting college players that they might be able to draft to write about how I thought they might fit in within the Knicks system. So I did scout a little bit that year. But other than that, I don't even really pretend to watch much college basketball other than maybe, you know, a bigger Michigan game or something where I'm watching my alma mater.
Right. So I
remember seeing a little bit of the highlights from that game where he was playing in a 4-on-5 at Alabama after
3-on-5, actually.
You're right. It wasn't, that was insane. Who was that against? Florida State or somebody?
I have no idea. I mean, I'm probably even worse than you. I do not watch college basketball, and I appreciate that you say that as well, because I feel like people that cover the NBA in general feel like we have to have an opinion on everything, and to say, no, that's just not really my wheelhouse. I don't watch a lot of it. I really do appreciate that. That's refreshing.
I literally just had somebody text me this morning about an idea that he had, and he was like, I was hoping to quote you, and you know, hoping that we could do a handful of podcasts together this year. I said, look, I'm particularly with younger writers and people that are kind of starting out, I want to help them as much as I would have wanted to help when I was younger, as far as, you know, if I can get someone to speak to or someone that I feel like I respect their opinion. So I didn't want to completely pop an air in this balloon. I said, I'll help you when I can. But I have to be honest, one, this thing you're asking me about right now to comment on, I'm not going to comment on that because I really don't have a firm opinion and I haven't studied it. And so I prefer not to. And I've actually told my bosses from 538 that too. One of my bosses wanted me to do a much longer take out on Zion Williamson in the middle of the season to work mm-hmm. on in the middle of the season and then basically have it ready to roll out during the tournament. And I said, I'm not going to parachute in and write something about him right now when you asked me to be fully committed to NBA stuff. So that I could actually stay ahead on that. I don't feel like it's a good trade-off as we're about to start the playoffs to totally turn my attention away from NBA and then work toward it. You know, like I haven't watched him play a single time. I had not watched Zion play a single entire game at that point. So,
right.
So to your question, I hadn't watched him in college really. And I didn't have any real expectations at all. I mean, I'd heard what everybody else had about his scoring ability, but I couldn't have told you really what his strong points were, what his weaknesses were, aside from the ability to score. And within mm-hmm. that, you know, I think I always have questions about people and how their scoring ability will translate when they're as small as he is, not
right.
a big guy. And, you know, and I think that those things became very relevant during the season, that he, you know, was finding plenty of open shots, but was, you know, finding them in a part of the court where teams are pretty willing to let you have them. And so, you know, wasn't ever really a bad shooter, but was taking shots from, he wasn't playing smart, efficient basketball, which I feel like if your point guard takes that sort of playing style, it's going to be hard for the offense as a whole to really be successful. And then you mix it in with the fact that, again, he's smaller and was never really known for his defense. And so when you're relying on him to be that, you know, on some level, you know, kind of the entry point to your defense, if he's not solid there, it's going to hurt you. And so, I mean, I think that regardless of what we talk about with his offense, which I think there were some really bright spots there toward the end of the year, for sure, the defense was problematic, and it was problematic to the tune of the Cavs having the worst defense statistically in history. And so I think that, you know, you have to factor that in. I think there are a lot of people that, you know, were wondering how it was that he wasn't on the all-rookie team or the all-rookie first team or whatever it was, despite how nice a second half he had. You know, it's a two-way sport. And, you know, he just was not really good on the one side. And he was pretty bad on the one side. But I think there was a lot of things to be encouraged by on the other side of the ball, particularly in the second half of the season.
Yeah, what was impressive to me, and I mean, you hear most of the young players that come into the NBA, you'll hear talk of them being gym rats and just how good of a work ethic they have, because it's apparently tough to get into the NBA. I've heard rumors of that. So I never know what to really make of that. And for Sexton to change his kind of shot profile so much throughout the course of the season, and for him to take what was basically his only real strength, which was the mid-range jumper, and recognize that, hey, in today's NBA, that's actually a weakness, that I'm taking all these shots, even if I'm making them at an okay clip, and to kind of develop the strength and develop that outside shot, that's an impressive amount of kind of self-awareness from a 19-year-old kid. I mean, I probably don't even have that now at 28. So that really impressed me. When you're looking at what needs to change with him moving forward, obviously there's two big areas, which is defense and playmaking. What do you feel, if you were to pick one to prioritize coming into the season, which do you think would make the biggest difference? And is that at all impacted by the presence of Darius Garland now being drafted alongside him?
Oh, of course that aspect is impacted by that, because all of a sudden now you may not need him to playmake as much. Now, I think in today's NBA, if you could have five playmakers out there, you would want that. So it's not to say that we should just kind of say he doesn't need to improve in that respect anymore. Also, they're not going to play every single minute together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you might want to play them apart a little bit to try to get a sense of maybe which guy is more worth keeping, depending on their individual skill sets and stuff like that. But you need him to improve as a playmaker. But I kind of feel like, you know, going back to what I said just before, if he doesn't improve defensively, we're talking about something where, regardless of how good he gets on offense, it's going to be a problem. And, you know, there have been teams that have been able to work around that to some extent. And you've also got teams that I think are still trying to figure out how to work through that. So I think, you know, I think the Hawks are an interesting example with Trey, in the sense that he is, you know, I don't know that he'll ever be a plus defender. And I think there are certain elements of his game that make up for the fact that he may not ever be. He is someone who has incredible, incredible range, who, you know, I think at some point may reach a Steph level where you've got to guard him 35 feet from the basket, and if you don't, he'll make you pay for it. If you're able to draw the defense like that and then able to whip passes around the way he does and, you know, and hit shots, I think he might have made either his shots from 30 feet and out at a higher percentage than Dame and Steph, or maybe he made more of them and took more of them. I can't remember. I know he was right up there in the top three, if not number one, right, in the league. But he projects a little bit differently, you know, in year one than Colin Sexton does. And, you know, he has weaknesses, but they're not necessarily the exact same weaknesses that Sexton has. I think that, you know, that so the Hawks will have to figure out how to work around Trey's defensive weaknesses. Sexton, if he's not able to defend better, particularly now that he's going to have another guard on the court with him that is going to be 6'2", you're already starting at a disadvantage defensively just from a height standpoint. And then when you factor in IQ and ability to move your feet and stay in front on screens and stuff like that. If he can't negate some of his weaknesses there, it's going to be really problematic for the Cavs, who already are, you know, trying to fight through some of the other shortcomings they've got on that side of the ball. So I feel like defense is going to be the biggest thing, which is always tough because a lot of times you kind of have someone that can play defense or you don't. And, you know, there are things that you can try to pick up on that make you smarter on the court, that make you less averse to the idea of giving up corner shots or, you know, ducking under screens constantly when you don't have to. But I feel like they're going to need to try to squeeze every bit of the IQ out of him that they can to make up for, you know, his physical shortcomings on defense and playmaking. You know, there were some elements of last year that made it seem like playmaking were maybe, you know, set to improve a little bit, but I think that there's less pressure on that when you've got two guards back there who both kind of came up as point guards. You have more faith in the ability that one of those guys will really get in the gear with that and will be solid at handling the ball and setting up for others. So you may not need that as much for them, but defensively you're going to need them to improve no matter what.
Yeah. I feel that kind of feeds into what John Beilein has done historically as well, where he has had a lot of guys kind of initiating the playmaking. And you look back at Kevin Love when he was in Minnesota, obviously he initiated a lot of offense. Jetty Osman has shown some of that. So I definitely agree with your assessment that defense should kind of be the biggest priority, because even though he just 6'2", as you mentioned, he does at least have a positive wingspan at 6'8", I believe. And if he can kind of fill out and at least become kind of neutral defensively, I think it makes it a little easier to play him and not doom him to just a career as a bench kind of spark plug. When you're analyzing just kind of the importance of defense and individual defense in comparison to the rest of the team, do you kind of weigh both sides equally depending on position? Because to me, it feels like guard defense isn't necessarily a 50-50 thing. Obviously, it's a little different when you're talking about playing two point guards essentially together. But in the grand scheme of things, it seems like when you start getting to the front court, defense becomes a little more integral to the overall team performance on that end of the floor. Whereas with guards, it feels like if they can at least be sound positionally and not really get burnt off ball and kind of be where they're supposed to be, it's a lot easier to scheme around that.
Yeah, no, I mean, there's no question that, you know, I think you can look as recently as kind of the last dynasty, pseudo-dynasty that we had with the Warriors. You know, I think there were several conversations had around the fact that Steph was improving defensively. You know, some people would go as far as to tell you that Steph is good defensively. Mm-hmm. Wherever you stand on that, he was still kind of one of the weaker links on that side of the ball for the Warriors, if not the weakest link.
Right. And that was a high bar too, because you had great defenders around him.
Right. You know, and the Cavs were able to play him off the floor at times. And I think basically the Cavs were able to kind of just screen him to death as best they could, to where the Warriors had to scheme stuff differently. So yeah, and you look at that, you look at the Blazers, who, you know, Dame has never been a great defender. There's limitless, you know, Westbrook has not been good defensively for several years. So there's no question that you can survive without having a good point guard. And that teams, basically, I think it's kind of expected that you're not going to be really good defensively if you're a point guard in this league, with the exception of a handful of guys. I think Drew Holiday has been a consistent example of that. I think Chris Paul, you know, I think Lonzo Ball is definitely kind of on track to be that if he can stay healthy. Mm-hmm. So there are a few guys, but it's not expected, and it's more of a plus if you're good on that side. Now, I do think that when, you know, there is a threshold that if you're so bad on that end of the floor that at a certain point, it kind of has a ripple effect to where, okay, yes, your bigs are more important than your guard, but if your bigs are compromised constantly because your guard can't ever stay in front, and all of a sudden they have to guard the rim on every play, and then they have to come off their guy in the post to try to stop penetration to the basket, at a certain point, you know, then it's really, really problematic. And you know, I remember covering the Knicks, and Tyson Chandler was literally coming off Defensive Player of the Year, but, you know, Raymond Felton couldn't stand in front of anybody, and neither could anybody else. You know, Carmelo was bad defensively. Shumpert was really gambling a whole lot. And so there just weren't any good defenders out there, J.R. Smith. And so everybody was kind of like an absent-minded defender, and Tyson was out there by himself with, you know, maybe the weakest defensive player out there being Felton. And so, you know, I think we've all seen examples of when a guard is just not able to stand in front of anyone. And because of it, you know, it just kind of has a really detrimental effect on everybody else. So that's what I'm saying, is that I think to some extent why it's important to squeeze those IQ points out of Sexton from a defensive standpoint, because even if he's just in the right place, that will help you. If he's not able to stay in front of people, then it's just going to be too problematic, I think, for the minutes that you're going to have to play Kevin Love at the four or at the five. You know, I think Tristan, it's hard to really pick up on whether Tristan, it'd be interesting to get people's perspective there defensively of like whether he's taking a step back, if that's him, if it's just who he's playing with. I think that he probably still has a lot of value. And we've seen when he's not there, how much value he has when other people are trying to fill in for him, how problematic it is defensively. So we'll see. But I do think that it's one of those things where Sexton needs to be better and needs to play above a certain threshold so that he's not killing the rest of the defense with how bad he is on that end.
Yeah, and I think the biggest thing for Tristan, too, is just he started getting hurt, and he stopped being an Iron Man, and he just hasn't had the same kind of mobility and was barely able to stay on the floor last year. We had talked to Seth Partnow a couple weeks ago, and we were just kind of talking about how much of defense we feel is, like, accurately captured within statistics. I think we've done a better job. Collectively, we've done a better job capturing what happens on offense in comparison to defense. How much do you think a lot of the metrics that are out there have captured accurately right now? Because it does seem, to some extent, we're just kind of taking the overall team output on that end and working backwards and trying to assign how much of that is the responsibility of each player.
Yeah, I mean, I work for a site that just tried to put out a defensive metric, and, you know,
mixed reception.
Yeah. I mean, the perception of it is so all over the map. And it's funny because I think, you know, I got so many text messages from people who I really respect. And I should also say that I didn't have anything to do with the metric. It's funny. I'm viewed as like a numbers person, but I don't think I'm good at math. I also really don't like math very much. I think I just ask questions rooted in math, you know, to try to get closer to answering a question through math. And I think that that's probably the best way to think about the defensive metrics that are out there, including our own is at 538, is that it's not meant to be a total catch-all statistic and, you know, saying that this is how you find who the best defender in the league is. I think it's to tell you, you know, like anything, who, you know, for the most part, probably who is good and who is bad, but also to try to give you a sense of who we might not be giving enough credit to, and to try to get closer to the answer of why that is, and maybe to draw your attention to something. But, you know, the Draymond metric that we created at 538 is not meant to be – it's meant to be part of a larger context for the way we think about defense and the way we think about a player. I don't think that – you know, the question that you raised about Sexton, whether – it's a total 50-50 split offensively and defensively in terms of the way we should consider how good a player is or how useful a player is. No, probably not. But I think, you know, as you get to certain positions, probably it should be closer to that. And when you're talking about the average player, so meaning not a guy that averages 20 or 25 a game, I think that you also have to consider the fact that role players probably need to be a little bit more balanced because they're less likely to be stars. And so you're less likely to have as much tolerance for them being bad on defense. So there's a whole lot of different things to consider, but I think that, you know, defense, I think most people are still relatively clueless in how they talk about the game and how heavily to weigh certain things regarding defense. And I think a lot of that does stem from the fact that we just don't have that many numbers to draw from. And even the ones we have to draw from, how heavily should you weigh certain things? How much should you take certain things into account? How heavily should you weigh the minutes that someone is playing with other people who are really good at something? So, right, you know, defensively, if someone's on-off numbers are great, you have to consider that that might be because they're playing with a really, really dominant rim protector or a really good person who pressures the ball, you know, coming up the court for the other team. So there are all sorts of things that I feel like we haven't, you know, really untangled completely. I think some people try to. I think there's constantly blowback. You know, I watched a lot of people, it's always kind of interesting to kind of be in a spot where people are criticizing, whether it's statisticians or analysts that are trying to develop something new, which I understand. That's not to say that stuff should be, you know, that is stuff is bulletproof. But at the same time, it's like, well, I think you need people to make suggestions and to try to create statistics to try to get closer to what the answer is. And I don't know that we'll ever have one, because this stuff just is not as easy to track as offenses. And that's just all there is to it.
Hey guys, we're going to get back to my interview with Chris Herring in just a second. But first, we got to give a shout out to our sponsors. The first of which is Axios Sports. There are countless ways to keep up to date on what's happening in the world of sports, but how are you supposed to read every great article? How are you supposed to watch every single awesome highlight without losing time in your busy day? Scrolling through every app and visiting every website on a daily basis is impossible. Now coming to the stage, Axios Sports. Axios Sports is a modern sports page delivered directly to your email inbox. Each morning, you'll see the best stories from around the sports world, from the NBA and NFL to niche sports like cricket and ping pong. The email newsletter highlights the most important stats and trends, giving you the ability to stay informed. It's super simple to sign up. Sports.axios.com. Axios Sports is clean, crisp, and gives you everything you need to know. Read it in 5 minutes in the elevator, or discover a deep dive article while you're on your train to work. Not only will you be caught up, you'll be the cool person sharing an amazing link with your friends and coworkers. Join the 100,000 sports fans who get caught up on the day before it even begins. And best of all, there's no paywall, no subscription fee, nothing. This is free, curated sports content delivered directly to you. Do yourself and your time a favor. Sign up for the Axios Sports newsletter for free at sports.axios.com. Seriously, I subscribe to it and it makes me feel more informed without spending any time clicking through websites, apps, or social media platforms. Again, try for free at sports.axios.com. And while Axios keeps you caught up in the world of sports, how about you take some time to take care of your own health? Guys, we're terrible at taking care of our own health. Whether it's a knee injury, bad back, or something worse, guys are usually more comfortable rubbing some dirt on it than seeing a doctor. And I'm guilty of it myself. I mean, I played basketball on a dislocated knee for a good year or two, and now I don't have a meniscus. So I am certainly one of the many that hasn't taken good care of their health. And the same can be true for erectile dysfunction. Studies show that 70% of guys who experience ED don't get treated for it. Thankfully, Roman created an easy way to chat with a doctor online. With Roman, you can get medical care for ED, if appropriate, from the comfort and privacy of your own home. You can handle everything in a convenient, discreet manner. Getting started is simple. Just go to getroman.com/bluewire and complete an online visit. If your doctor decides that treatment would be appropriate, they can prescribe genuine medication that can be delivered in discreet packaging right to your door with free 2-day shipping. Guys, go to the doctor. Erectile dysfunction can be tough to tackle, but it's really important to get checked out. With Roman, it's easy to connect with a doctor. Just go to getroman.com/bluewire to get a free online visit and free 2-day shipping. That's getroman.com/bluewire for a free visit to get started. getroman.com/bluewire. And now, back to our interview with Chris.
Right, right. And I don't think there's anything necessarily wrong with any one metric that's out there. It's just people that kind of use that definitively where, okay, this tells you exactly what's happening. And I don't think anyone at 538 or the people that kind of champion RPM, things like that, I don't think that's really the intention. But because defense can be so subjective, I do think people that don't have the time to watch every team, they just, okay, well, let's look at those catch-all metrics and try to come up with an opinion on a player. And it's going to be interesting to see how that evolves, especially as tracking data improves, whether or not we can start to capture more, a little more accurately defensively. But ultimately, I do think a lot of it is going to be tough to capture, just because we're never really going to know exactly what everyone's assignment's going to be. And you can have good defenders that have been part of very successful team defenses where you just get a bad matchup in the playoffs and teams are able to exploit one little weakness. And so much of the game kind of devolves into exploiting matchups once you do get to the playoffs.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think to piggyback on one of the things you were saying, I remember doing a story a couple of years ago, I guess, and thinking about more, technically it was a defensive story, and that was definitely the way it was intended, but it raised more questions about some of the stuff that I should have been thinking about more from an offensive perspective. That I think I wrote a story 2 years ago about the Spurs, who I think 3 seasons in a row, they were either ranked number one or number two in defending corner threes, which I was looking at by, you know, what percentage they allow from, right, from three, you know, or what percentage the other teams are making on corner threes when playing against the Spurs. And when I looked at it, you know, I immediately kind of thought, well, the Spurs must just really contest a lot harder than everybody else to have had that. And then when I looked at it, they actually ranked pretty much dead last in the league in contesting corner threes, and were still number one in the league at that metric. And so I kind of wrote that up saying, you know, this might be one of the longest streaks of luck that we've seen in a while. That, you know, while all of us want to just credit the Spurs for being so smart, that this suggests that maybe there's luck involved. And, you know, me being stupid, writing that up, not really using enough people as a sounding board before I wrote it. And, you know, a couple really smart people who work with numbers a bit more, and some other people throughout the league who I talked to a little bit more, kind of reached out and they said, you know, did you consider the fact that maybe the Spurs are leaving certain people wide open purposely, with the thought that, you know, if they leave them open, they're more likely to induce a shot from a certain player who wants to shoot but shouldn't be shooting from there. And then in leaving that person open, they miss the shot because they're not good shooters. Right. And maybe that's why the Spurs are number one. And then, you know, doing more reporting, talking to Kawhi and a couple other people, they essentially said that, you know, they are as militaristic as it comes in the NBA, you know, Pop's background and everything, and just kind of the preparation that they have and the smarts they have, and the, you know, and the continuity that they had for a long time from year to year, that their guys were kind of drilled to know exactly who to leave open and who not to. And that was essentially appeared to be showing up in the statistics. And so, you know, I think that there are certain things that, you know, you have to be careful about what to really emphasize and what not to. You have no sense of what is more of a team concept for some of these teams versus others. I don't think a lot of people spend enough time asking questions around those things. I think that we're so often really fascinated by scoring and offense and knowing, understanding offenses more and what the point of offenses is. And, you know, the idea of, you know, essentially playing chess or tic-tac-toe, that you might do things to free up one person that people may not know about. And defense works exactly the same way. But, you know, it's really funny. I remember interviewing Shump in New York, and at one point he didn't snap at all, but he kind of had just like, he was kind of puzzled. He was like, why are you always asking me questions about what we do on defense? Because he's like, no one's ever asked me so many questions about defense before. And I said, well, first off, I'm asking you because you're one of the few people on this team, him and I think Tyson Chandler are the only two, who has a somewhat defensive reputation compared to, you know, anybody else on this team. You know, I'm also talking to JR and Carmelo and Felton and Calderon or whoever else is on the team. I'm like, I don't have that many options. Secondly, you guys are playing defense a different way than most teams do, where they were switching stuff, kind of jump switching at a time where nobody else was doing that. And so, you know, I kind of feel like to get into a coach's psyche or to get into strategic stuff, it's half-hearted to only ask about offense and not defense when it's worth just as much. Maybe not on an individual scale, but definitely from a team standpoint, and sometimes worth more if your defense is that problematic that you're going to have to score more because of it. And so, you know, I wish that we asked more questions around the strategy. I wish there were more metrics out there. I wish that people cared more about it relative to – you know, the way they watch games. I think we're trained to watch the ball more than we are to watch rotations and defense. And so, you know, it's an interesting thing, but someday hopefully we'll get closer on it. But I'm not sure that we'll ever be completely caught up offensively and defensively the way we think about it.
Yeah, I think it is going in the right direction, though. I think we're seeing more and more kind of people that use the data in creative ways and highlight things. And I certainly think you do a very good job of that as well, just kind of applying the metrics to the game and creating smarter fans. I do think that it's trending in the right direction, and it's just a matter of us kind of, as the data improves, I think more and more people are going to adapt it. Now, one thing is, that I certainly noticed, and the Carmelo rankings are a good example of this. They can be pretty dang low on young players, and young players you can see the variance year to year in their performance, and that's where you can see players either make leaps or regress or stagnate. How much stock would you put into those first couple of years of a prospect? And obviously Colin Sexton's an example of that. He rates out as a negative asset in Carmelo rankings, but also other guys that are coming in, whether it be Darius Garland, Kevin Porter Jr., Dylan Windler. From a Cavs fan perspective, we're obviously trying to figure out what these guys are going to be and whether or not they can be part of the future and whether or not they're building blocks. And how much stock would you put into some of those rankings when it comes to analyzing the young guys?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that should be kept in mind for those, because I remember, you know, you talked about the Cavs players. I know that I saw the worst projection that I've ever seen, where it literally, I'm almost positive it jumps off the page, is Kevin Knox. I think he was the one rookie that had worse advanced metrics than Sexton did. And in looking at him, he literally, if you look at the Carmelo page for him, he literally does not fit totally on the page for how he did last year, and barely starts to come off, you know, like back onto the page. It basically suggests that he'll improve, that he'll basically become a pretty much a league average guy 5-6 years from now. But I think what we have to keep in mind with that, and I don't think the average person understands this or cares to understand it. You know, like I said, I don't consider myself to be a huge numbers person. I know that that's probably not the perception for me, that it probably is that I am a big numbers person, but all the Carmelo ratings are doing, from my understanding, is that they're laying out a confidence interval, which has a huge span. Basically, I think from the 10th percentile to the 90th percentile of what would be expected based on the year we just saw from someone. So yes, obviously someone can have a totally different year two than they did year one. But it's basically saying, like, within what we've seen historically, you generally fall somewhere in this range. And so young guys are going to have wider confidence intervals, because that's basically to say that we're not that confident in what they're going to do one year to the next, because we've never seen them play but for the one season. And so, you know, Knox is starting in a bad place because of how rough a first year he had. I think Sexton is kind of in a similar boat, just because the first few months for him were so brutal. Right. And even as he was playing better, he was still part of, if you want to say he was the key reason, the sole reason, whatever, of a historically the worst defense we've ever seen. You know, whether or not you feel like it should be balanced 50-50 in the way we think about it, you factor that in with the fact that he had a really rough start to his season and then was part of a season-long worst effort, NBA worst effort on the defensive end, it's bound to scale out in a way that is poor. And so the confidence intervals are kind of all over the place for young players like that, particularly when they're that bad. So it wouldn't shock me if either one of them improved quite a bit. I hope they both improve, because I think that they have potential. I think that they showed flashes. I know Kevin Knox had a couple of good games last year as well. And so I wouldn't put a ton of stock into that. You know, I think it's something that is more useful for veteran players or for guys that have been in the league for at least 3 or 4 years, where the, you know, their numbers have started to normalize a little bit, and we get a sense of what they can do. And I think even more so for guys that are probably closer to 26, 27, I think it's more interesting from an aging curve standpoint than it is from, you know, I don't think we have any way right away of knowing young players exactly how they're going to perform. I mean, another example from my world would be that the season I started covering the Knicks was the same summer that Jeremy Lin was a free agent with the Knicks, and the Knicks had said that they would spend whatever was necessary to keep him as a restricted free agent. And, you know, the numbers at that point were basically saying that no point guards had ever averaged what Lin was averaging over that 2-week Lin sanity run, or however long it was. It's like Magic Johnson, Derrick Rose, you know, Jeremy Lin. Like, there were very few people who'd ever averaged what he had. And, like, most of them were MVPs or close to it. They were all essentially on Hall of Fame trajectories, you know, with that sort of run that he had with the Knicks. And so it looks like a no-brainer to sign the guy for whatever money he wants. And obviously the Knicks had Uncle at a certain point, didn't re-sign him. And, you know, at this point, you know, we can talk about the wisdom of having signed him, not re-signing him, whatever. But, you know, numbers, the less time someone's in the league, the more you can kind of manipulate their numbers one way or the other for the sake of an argument to basically say that you should invest everything you have in them versus the idea of like cutting them loose. And that's very true for guys that are only 19 or 20 years old. So I personally wouldn't put too much stock in it. I do think it's a little concerning when you're talking about some of the worst advanced metrics ever. Metrics mean more than they did before, you know, now that we have them and we didn't even have them before. I do think that that suggests something, but it doesn't mean that they can't completely reverse it the next year. You know, their rosters are likely to change a lot because they're on young teams that are not very good. And so their advanced metrics may look bad anyway, even if they're not bad players. So I wouldn't put too much stock in it. I think they mean something, but I don't think they mean nearly as much as, you know, I think people rag on these guys pretty hard. And I don't think that it's worth doing that because I just think we haven't seen enough yet.
Right. Well, the Cavs are certainly good at being historic, whether it's erasing historic deficits or being very, very memorably bad. I'm looking forward to see how that adjusts. My hot take for the Cavs is that they can get to 29th defensively. I really think that next year we can be not the bottom. I don't know who's going to be worse, but I have a feeling someone's going to find a way to be worse. And now, going back into your wheelhouse a little bit, I know you said you didn't watch tons of college basketball, but I want to know if you have any opinions about how John Beilein's going to transition to the NBA. Because obviously you're an alum of the University of Michigan, so sure. I was wondering if you had any takes on how he's going to kind of transition.
Well, I'm still kind of heartbroken that he left. It's weird. Very rarely does my fandom kind of obscure anything about the NBA stuff that I'm working on. You know, Michigan has produced its fair share of NBA players. I kind of feel like I am generally lower on those players than most people because I've kind of seen their flaws up close. And so, you know, a lot of Knicks fans were curious about what I thought about Brazdeikis, for instance, because he got drafted there. I remember when the Knicks drafted Hardaway that fans thought I was – it's weird. Like, you know, on some level, a lot of times you call people homers, and I kind of feel like I'm the polar opposite with regards to players that come out of Michigan because I'm always thinking that, you know, that they're thought of more highly – league-wide than I think of them because I know of their weaknesses. Mm-hmm. I remember not thinking that the Hardaway pick was a smart one for the Knicks and thinking that they should have taken somebody else instead. But anyway, I think Beilein, I think his style of offense actually works fine for the NBA. What I worry about a little bit, I don't know that it will be as cutting edge at the NBA as it is at the college level. Because obviously it's kind of a five out, you know, kind of pro style, just kind of we're going to screen and roll you as many times we need to get what we need. And that has a lot of success. It has a much different look and a different feel at the college level. I also think that on some level, even though his teams were at the very top of college basketball as far as how often they were taking threes and stuff like that, that the gap was starting to close a little bit. I know they were basically, you know, number one or number two in the nation in three-point attempt rate. But, you know, there was a time where they were kind of pretty much by themselves, basically by themselves. And now, you know, just as we've seen everywhere, high school level, younger than that, people are shooting way more threes. And so it's not quite as unique, but I think that, you know, he'd obviously built very good offenses and very good defenses. And what I thought he was uniquely good at is that he has an eye for talent that other people kind of keep on the sidelines or don't really think is that good. And so I remember Trey Burke was not, you know, a totally, totally sought after recruit. And then next thing you know, he's National Player of the Year. Nick Stauskas was someone that was in Canada and was not, you know, to my knowledge, I don't think was heavily, heavily recruited by the most major programs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Michigan turns him into a Big Ten Player of the Year and a lottery pick. And so I think that he was good at that. I don't know how that sort of thing translates to the NBA. It's hard to kind of pick out a lot of clear examples of guys that have done really, really well at the NBA level for him. They get there, he gets them in the lottery range or first round range. And, you know, some of them have hot streaks. I know Hardaway has had moments where he's looked great. But, you know, they normally don't come in as totally finished product. And I'm not really sure what that means for the NBA. I don't know that he needs to coach people up in that regard to make them more they're playable or, you know, draftable in the NBA. He needs to kind of take on that. And I don't know how much you really lean on your coaches for development purposes anyway, as much as you do for scheme stuff. You've got player development people there in the building aside from just him. So I don't know. I'm kind of curious. I mean, I was probably more surprised than I should have been that he took the job. I know he had been flirting with the idea of the Pistons job, I think, the year before. So I don't know that I should be that surprised by the fact that he made the leap. I was a little bit surprised that that the Cavs wanted to take him. You know, he's a little bit older, and so a lot of times with a younger team, you hope to kind of bring in someone who is younger and to work with them, who can maybe get through a little bit differently. It'll be a challenge. I don't know. I you know, college is different in this, from the standpoint that guys kind of have to listen to you, and then mm-hmm. it's a lot of times more of a paternalistic sort of relationship. I don't view Beeline as being that way. I don't think he's, you know, a hard ass in that regard as far as how he coaches guys. Guys have always gotten along with him very well. But it's different. And so I really don't, you know, I hate that I don't have more of a take on that. But I don't know how he'll do. I could see it going well. I could see it not going well. And if it doesn't go all that well for him, I don't even know that we'd be able to tell right away if that's him or if that's just the talent. You know, they're already kind of gambling with the idea of, you know, two smaller guards. We just talked about the defense, for instance, and, you know, the idea that if you're going to kind of have a group that small in your backcourt, how does that translate and kind of have a chain reaction on the rest of your defense? So there are already going to be some tests right away that he's really got to fix the defense. His defenses were good at Michigan, but I've always thought of him more as an offensive coach and someone who scheme-wise is kind of ahead of the curve of his peers. So I really don't know. I hope he does well, if for no other reason that I think he left a job that he could have been comfortable in for the rest of his career. And you never want to see people kind of do that at the back end of a career age-wise and then flounder. And so I hope he does well. I think I've said this before on Twitter that I have a pretty big soft spot in my heart for Cleveland, not necessarily the team, but the city. So I hope they do well from that standpoint too, because I think Beeline is a good dude and I'm rooting for him from that standpoint.
Yeah, I certainly hope that. I mean, at the very least, it's not like he's walking into a great situation. I think we're all very aware of that. But if it could at least be fun, if it could at least be fun offensively, we understand that there's not the talent to really compete right away. And if he can at least connect with the young guys, and obviously there isn't the same kind of recruiting edge with the NBA, but if he can get guys to outperform where they were drafted or what people previously thought of them, that would be really good. One more thing before I get you out of here. As a Canadian, I have to ask you, what are your feelings about RJ Barrett? Are you a believer in RJ?
I feel so bad about having so little knowledge about all this college stuff. Another guy I did not watch much. I will say this from having watched a couple of summer league games. Mm-hmm. I didn't make quite as much. You know, he definitely struggled in summer league. There's no way around it.
It wasn't great.
Picked it up a little bit toward the end. I was kind of underwhelmed, and a lot of people were like, okay, well, that just shows you haven't watched him. And I fully admit I had not. And so, I don't really – not really ashamed to say that. More so than his offense, which he looks maybe a third or a half step slower than I probably just expected based on where he was drafted in terms of his quickness. Like, he doesn't blow by really anybody. But I think my biggest concern from having watched Summer League is just – his vision is not very good. It's definitely not elite. And a lot of times when you are that good of a scorer to where you're attracting that much defensive attention in the first place, on some level, you know, you could say it's harder because you're getting more defensive attention on you. But in some ways it makes the game easier if you're willing to make the right play, because then, you know, you're attracting the attention of a second defender. And so then by virtue of doing that, then there's somebody else on your team open who, if you hit them at the right moment, you know, you can get an easy basket out of it. I didn't see him taking advantage of that really at all in summer league. And there were a lot of examples where you kind of watch something back, or you watch a replay, or you watch a film cut up that someone puts together. And there are just so many opportunities that he kind of left on the floor, where in watching it in real time, you may not see it, but then you watch it over again and you're like, man, he's really got to just make the easy play. And part of me wondered after those first two or three games where he really, really just struggled from the floor shooting it, if he was kind of feeling under more pressure to, you know, that he had to score. And so he was looking to score even more than he normally would to try to prove a point. And so I think he'll have plenty of time to fix that stuff. It will be interesting just because I don't the Knicks have so many front court guys now that are all more
they really do.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I mean, I think there were jokes to be made about it, and rightly so, and whatever. Mm-hmm. You know, Knicks fans, some of them were kind of in their feelings about the jokes that are being made. They did go into the offseason without a whole lot of front court guys. I think on some level at center, that probably was probably the right approach because I think Mitch Robinson deserves a lot more minutes to see what you have in him.
I really like him. I think he's going to be great.
Yeah, I mean, he had too good of a rookie season to not throw more minutes at him, whether foul troubles are an issue or not. But they really didn't have, like, any power forwards on the roster. And so I think it was totally, you know, their first two or three signings, for the most part, were all power forwards, which is, you know, made for a good show. But, I mean, they needed them. I don't think they needed as many of them as they got, and I think that they have a lot of positional overlap. But it will be interesting to kind of watch with all these guys they just signed, Randall being one of them. This is not necessarily set up to be a team or an offense where Barrett can just kind of take shots at will. And I don't know that that would be the best thing for his progression anyway. But I'm curious because I did see some things that I thought were, no, I wouldn't say concerning, but definitely that I thought would be a little bit farther along from him as a number two pick. Number four pick. That I thought would be a little bit farther along with him than they actually were. And so we'll see. I don't think it's necessarily a problem at all. I think that we'll just have to watch it during the season. And he'll probably progress a ton during the season. But I didn't really care as much about the scoring. I think that stuff comes. You either can score or you can't. I was a little bit surprised from a passing standpoint. So I hope he improves there.
No, I'm with you. I mean, it hurts me to admit, but he did seem a little bit slower from what I saw than I would have anticipated, just not as athletic. I think he's going to work out, but I'm going to be rooting for the Knicks now, just out of pure nationalism there. We need one of these top guys to really work out. I do love Jamal Murray, and there's other great Canadian players, but I need RJ Barrett to work out. But Chris, thank you so much for your time. Really, really do appreciate you coming on the podcast. For all of our listeners, you can obviously find him at Herring_NBA. If you are listening to the podcast and you don't know who Chris is, I don't know what to tell you. I'm assuming you have a bit bigger of a following than us, but really do appreciate your time, and I appreciate all of our supporters and listeners. Remember, if you want to support the podcast, you can do so by leaving a rating, leave a review, subscribe, unsubscribe, resubscribe, and help take advantage of Apple's poor metrics. And if you want to be part of our Discord chat, you can send a screenshot of that review to chasedownpod@gmail.com, and we'll send you a link. So thanks again to Chris. Thank you to our listeners. Until next time. Go Cavs.